And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Ryan Young, your host, and we have a great show for you today. We actually are going to have a whole panel of people talking about the City Nature Challenge and the Campus Biodiversity Network. So stay tuned for that. And the BioBlitz, which is part of the City Nature Challenge, or is the City Nature Challenge, is coming up very soon, this Friday, April 26th, and runs for 4 days. So we've got lots to talk about, but first we're going to play some music and hear some Stevie Wonder, and we'll be right back after that.
Doozy hardly seem to be unfair, 'cause you say that you found another man. Tuesday breakup, guess you just don't care, 'cause you found you another man. Catch a baby, catch you with my dreams. Maybe then I could see you all the time.
And that was Tuesday Heartbreak by Stevie Wonder. And it is Tuesday. And it's the day after Earth Day. So happy Earth Day, or happy belated Earth Day. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And my name is Ryan Young. I'm your host for today. And we have a whole gang of people in the studio today to talk about the City Nature Challenge and the Campus Biodiversity Network. And so I'll just mention who's here before we start our discussion. But we've got Chris Cloutier, who teaches in the Environmental and Wildlife Management program at Vanier College. We've got Catherine Collin, who is a teacher in the English department at Vanier College, but also the project lead of the Campus Biodiversity Network. They are also hosting the City Nature Challenge. So we're going to talk all about the history of that. But we've also got Andy Plimer, who teaches in the physical education, outdoor education department at John Abbott College. And he's a birder. And we also have Brian Mader, who is biologist who teaches in the biology department at Dawson College. So we've got all the SAGEPs pretty well represented here. And of course, I'm a teacher in the media arts department at John Abbott College as well, but I'm also a host of this show. So let's start. So, Catherine, you are the founder of the Campus Biodiversity Network. So can you tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. So thanks so much for having us. The Campus Biodiversity Network was launched around COP15, in the lead up to COP15. And it's essentially a consortium of post-secondary institutions, so colleges and universities in Quebec, but also internationally, who are trying to prioritize biodiversity observations on their campuses. So encouraging people across disciplines, whether it's staff, students, faculty, to get out and start to document the biodiversity we have on campus. And we do this through a couple of community science tools, most notably of which is iNaturalist, and that enables us to have a kind of forward-facing biodiversity profile for each of our campuses, as well as a snapshot of our collective observations together. So we can track how many species we've observed collectively, how many observers get out. And so it's a nice way of showing that our campus green spaces have value ecologically in the urban spaces where they're located.
Nice. Now, the City Nature Challenge started, I think, in San Francisco or something like that. What's the story there?
Yeah, so just quickly, the City Nature Challenge was started in 2016 as a competition between the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco, and it quickly took off in popularity, both within the United States but also abroad. And this year, we have almost 700 cities in the world that are participating.
All during April 26th to April 29th.
That's correct.
Wow, that's great. And I guess there's a central website where people can track this, right?
Sure, yes. Yeah. So the central global website is citynaturechallenge.org. And the one that's specific for Greater Montreal, so the 82 cities within the Communauté Métropolitaine de Montréal, there's a site for that as well. It's DNU, as Défis Naturels Urbains, DNUMontreal.org.
Nice. And Brian, tell me about your involvement. I know Dawson College is going to participate as well.
Yeah, for sure. We're definitely participating in the City Nature Challenge. We have a community BioBlitz on campus on Monday afternoon, and I have a couple classes that have confirmed their attendance, but it's actually a community event, so it's open to anyone if anybody wants to come onto campus on that day, on Monday from 3 to 6. And we've been tracking biodiversity with the help of the Campus Biodiversity Network on campus for a little over a year now. And it's great to see classes getting involved, faculty getting involved, staff getting involved. And it's really fun because every time we find a new species on campus that's a little bit rare, my inbox kind of explodes. Like last week we had a turkey on campus, and I think I got about 30 messages from students and staff, and it was great.
Nice, nice. And Andy Plimer, who teaches in physical education and does a lot of outdoor ed, even teaching birding classes at John Abbott. How is John Abbott participating?
Yeah, so I got involved a couple years ago, meeting up with Kathy through the birding community. And I teach a nature identification course as one of our outdoor ed options. And so we were part of a grant last year that we created self-guided biodiversity walks on campus. And, you know, for those who don't know the John Abbott campus, it's beautifully located right on the St. Lawrence. It's very large, very, very diverse in terms of, you know, some open grassland, some edge habitats, and then some, you know, horticulturally planted species. So there's a lot of variety. So you know, that original project then springboarded into this project, creating the BioBlitz. So, yeah, when Kathy mentioned it to me, I was really keen for it, and I think our campus is perfectly situated for it, and we've also created a relationship with the Morgan Arboretum, McGill's very own Morgan Arboretum, to have it as a community space that's also participating in the BioBlitz. So really exciting to have those two events coming up this week.
That's great. And Chris Cloutier, you teach at Vanier, and you actually are teaching very much about wildlife and the environment. So what's your involvement like?
Well, I guess I'm fortunate to have a very attentive and eager audience in our students, you know, in the Environmental Wildlife Management Program that, you know, make these observations on their own. So it's easy to get them involved in a project like this. When we call for BioBlitz, we tend to get a lot of student involvement, which is nice. So, yeah, I'm there. I've been sort of an interpretive biologist or naturalist for a long time. And so just a geek of all trades, as I sort of call myself. So we'll be leading a lot of guided walks and workshops and things for the Friday and the Monday on our campus, as well as some other things in town on the Saturday. So,
nice. And I know Friday the weather's looking good.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Sunny, high of 15 or 14, something like that.
Perfect.
Yeah. Tell me about using the iNaturalist app to make these observations and maybe a little bit of history of the iNaturalist app.
Yes, so iNaturalist was conceived of by graduate students at the University of California, Berkeley, and then it quickly was adopted as a platform. We have the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History and the California Academy of Sciences and National Geographic. It's really been adopted worldwide as a very easy community science tool for making biodiversity observations. And we see more and more experts relying on it simply because it requires evidence of an observation. So for those birders who are listening in the community, eBird it operates primarily on the honor system. You're not required to submit proof of your observation through a photograph or an auditory recording. But iNaturalist is different that way. So to reach the level of a kind of verifiable research-grade observation, you have to provide evidence. And so that makes it very interesting, both for researchers around the world, but also people who are trying to document, say, for conservation. So it's very simple. There are two ways of making an observation. One is through the free, non-commercial educational app, iNaturalist, which is available for Android and iPhone, and the other is to go to iNaturalist.ca, which is the Canadian iNat, run by the Canadian Wildlife Federation, and you can submit your observations directly. If you want to use the app, you can simply press the button Observe, and that allows you to take a picture directly from within the app. You can also do that for a sound recording. You can also upload from your camera roll if you like, so you can take pictures, say, walking around on the way home, and then upload them very easily with the mobile app after you've made those observations. And the same is true for those of us who are kind of fancy photographers. You can upload those photographs directly onto a desktop browser. It's really quite simple. It's free. The one hurdle is potentially creating your user ID and account, and after that it's all very self-explanatory and intuitive.
I never knew about the sound recording part. So you could upload a song of a bird and it would do its best to identify.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that's, I guess, sort of one of the areas that, well, hopefully will be improved on in the future. But at the moment, when you upload sound or you record sound, you have to have an idea of what it is,
right,
in order to submit it. It won't give you suggestions as it would for a photo.
Right. Okay. So it's not like Merlin.
No, not yet.
Right.
But one tip is to operate both of those tools at the same time. So you can use Merlin and get a suggestion and then use that suggestion after having verified the spectrogram, maybe, to upload that observation.
Okay. Yep. Very interesting. Huh. And, I mean, I'm always impressed when I take a picture of a wildflower or even just the leaf of a plant and how accurate it can be. You know, usually it might give me three different options, and the first option is usually the correct one,
yep.
You know, and it often, you know, if it can't identify the species, it'll identify the family, you know, and that's not something that I thought I would see necessarily. Like, I remember when some of these apps began, and, you know, I was always a naturalist who had all my guides, and I would just go and figure it out with my guides, my vast library of field guides. And then now, like, I just never thought I could use an app for the same purpose, but it's obviously, and sometimes the other thing I find interesting is that it'll work as much with a horticultural flower in your garden as it will with a wildflower, you know, or a wild plant.
Yep.
Yeah. Impressive. So I know that we have a film event. Well, actually, why don't we talk a bit about the Vanier events? Because Vanier's got quite a lot going on, and they're all happening this week. Maybe even there's some events today.
No, we don't have anything today, but we have a really packed lineup starting tomorrow. So we have Daniel Krutt. Do you want to hold this?
No, I just want to know, is it open to the public?
It is, yeah. Okay. So it'll be happening in the auditorium. We have what's called the Sustainability Symposium, but it's heavily influenced by biodiversity. So we have a wetland ecologist coming in to talk. We have Carly Zeter, who is well-known for urban ecology of Concordia University. We also have Ganawake's Environmental Protection Office coming to talk about their ecological restoration and sharing a new film that they have produced called We Are Rejuvenating the Waters. That will be tomorrow at 1:30. And then the following day, we're going to have biologists like Morgan Jackson come and talk about the power of community science. We have the Yale Younger Poets Prize winner, John Lyles, who is an ecologist but also a poet, coming to talk about the intersection of literature and the natural world, and a variety of other really neat talks, nature illustration among them. So that's really exciting for the next 2 days. And then we have outdoor activities running on the Friday. So a joint nature walk with Cégep Saint-Laurent, because we're lucky to be located in an area of 50 hectares of green space shared with Cégep Saint-Laurent. And then on Monday, we'll have a morning bird walk. And that's in addition, as Chris mentioned, to the community implication that we have out in the Technopark wetlands. And I should mention that Technopark Oiseau is a co-host of the City Nature Challenge for Greater Montreal.
And so those events at Vanier, is there a website where they can go and
see? Yeah, so they're posted on the Vanier College website. If you just Google Sustainability Symposium 2024, okay, they'll come up for Vanier.
Yeah. Great. And Andy, at John Abbott, I know we've got some things going on. One is the film.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sure you'll talk about that in a minute. You know that in great detail. And, yeah, we've just been working really hard to engage students and engage teachers as well in the process. Being part of the outdoor ed, phys ed department, we've got a crew of teachers who love going to the outdoors, love citizen science and the benefits that can bring. And so I'm engaging those teachers. I'll be leading a couple of walks with some of our fitness classes that are going to have a low week fitness wise, and I'll be taking them around the campus and doing some bird identification. But really, iNaturalist lends itself well to trees, to fungi, to insects, and flowers and those kind of things. So I think it's awesome in terms of like the independence it can give students. They can go out by themselves. They don't need a teacher. They don't need an expert. They can use an app that is really, really accurate in the most regards. I think it's pretty empowering for them to be able to do that. And I see it with my class, just how excited students get when they connect with nature and they think it's something and then they actually get that right, or they think it's something and it leads them down a path another way. And I think the more we can do that with young people, the better. They're, for the most part, not overly engaged with nature. But that's a generalization, of course. But I think that I'd reword and say there's a lot of competition out there for nature. So we have to, as educators, really, really present nature as the go-to place, as opposed to a cell phone or something like that. And I think incorporating both with something like iNaturalist and eBird and Merlin and those kind of things is a really good way forward.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Brian, what's going on at Dawson? So I do you have some events or?
Yeah, so we definitely have, excuse me, like I mentioned, the BioBlitz on Monday. And we have a bunch of other events that I've been organizing with teachers, kind of like what Andy was saying. I kind of sent a mass email out to a bunch of teachers and said, hey, do you want to take your students outside and explore the campus? So I'll be taking students from a bunch of different programs out, including biology, phys ed, geology, and we'll be going outside and throughout the entire month, not just for this weekend, and celebrating biodiversity that way. You know, Dawson, the sustainability office at Dawson, I'm really lucky. We have a lot of support there. And they've been trying really hard to create these what we call micro habitats on campus, because we are downtown. It's a city block. There are houses all around us. There's no forested area, so we have to kind of create the spaces for biodiversity to flourish, right? And we can only do that on a small scale. So, you know, things like the Peace Garden on campus, which is probably our biggest biodiversity feature, you know, adding dead logs so that it attracts woodpeckers and beetles and all the other detritivores that can come to that area. You know, putting a pile of rocks, maybe we'll get a snake under there one day. Who knows?
but you must have been impressed about what things you have been able to attract, right?
Yes, it's definitely, being part of the Campus Biodiversity Network has definitely kind of brought to the attention of everyone on campus how much life we actually do have on campus. I think our last count, last time I checked, was at 830 species on a city block downtown, which is
amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Well, I will mention the film that is happening at John Abbott College. So on the first day of the BioBlitz, which is Friday, April 26th, this Friday, we have a filmmaker named William Croshar, who's coming to John Abbott to present his film Montréal Sauvage. And it's actually a French film, but it's like your typical wildlife documentary that you might see on the BBC with David Attenborough narrating. But instead, this is, I think, Raymond Cloutier is the narrator. And it's in French, but it's got subtitles. And it's really just a beautiful, moving kind of tribute to the wildlife on the Montreal Island. And, you know, he goes to Mount Royal, he goes all the way out to the Morgan Arboretum where St. Anne de Bellevue is, he goes, I think, far east, he sort of investigates this coyote den, which is in between like two highways on this little patch of green, you know, and that's where they've chosen their secretive den. So it's a really cool film, and William himself is a musician, a composer as well, who composes music for film and television, and does this kind of wildlife filmmaking on the side, and then he composed the music for his own wildlife film. And that's part of the beauty of this film, is the music is really, really great. And it's kind of like the work of a great artist musically and from a photography nature point of view. And of course you get to see Montreal in a really different way, and I think this is what we all talk about or always point out, is that so many Montrealers are unaware of the amazing biodiversity that is here on this island. And I mean, it is an island where all of these rivers meet up. From a geographical point of view, it is very interesting. There's so much water habitat because of that. And then there are because of the, I guess, microclimate that is kind of created here, you have species that are on the island, but then just north of the island, they don't exist that far north. There's still significant areas of green space on the island, you know, on the eastern tip and the western tip, and then in the middle with Mount Royal, and then of course some of the other areas that many of us have talked about, like the Technopark wetlands as well, or Technopark area, because it's not just wetlands. So I think, you know, this kind of an event really brings all that attention down to the biodiversity in a city. And Catherine, do you have other things that come to mind as I say this?
Well, I think from an academic perspective, we often get met with the question, you know, how our campuses can't possibly have ecological value. But we know, and I'll defer to the biologists on the panel, that we know that small patches actually do have significant value for conservation. A recent study that came out of Spain last summer showed that the taxonomic diversity of a university's green space in Spain was significantly higher than that of other green spaces in our urban areas. So we know that protecting our campus green space and enriching the biodiversity of those spaces, controlling invasive species in those spaces actually has quite significant value for an urban space. And that extends, of course, to all the what we call ecosystemic services that are rendered by kind of championing green space, so the mitigating heat island effects and controlling for flooding and air pollution, et cetera. So those are the things that I think, and the connectivity question with our community spaces that are often at risk of development as well.
For sure, for sure. And Chris, I mean, in general, as a somebody who loves nature, you were saying that your students being in the environmental and wildlife management program are kind of a captive audience. Mm-hmm. But during an event like this, do you get to interact with people who are not in that program? And
yeah, absolutely. And that's really, I think, sort of what's great about setting up events like this on, you know, a busy campus like ours, is we get students just walking by booths and seeing these sorts of activities, and we just generate interest. You know, we'll set up spotting scopes on, you know, interesting birds or things like that too. And it's just being able to just pull in, you know, the casual passerby, and just, again, with our students, and I think, you know, Kathy and myself too, being there, we're very enthusiastic. So it's easy to sort of, you know, pull people into that, you know, to get them sort of hooked a little bit on this. And it's an easy sell with an app like iNaturalist. I find that, you know, for a lot of people who maybe are a bit hesitant to get into even things like birding, I've seen this before, or, you know, nature observation, it's sort of like, I guess, almost like imposter syndrome, where it's like, I don't really know what those things are. But iNaturalist is a great bridge to that, because it does give suggestions on what things are. So you don't have to come from an area of expertise or any real nature background to be good at this, you know, to find things and submit those observations. And then you have, and we've all hinted at this, but like the real power of iNaturalist is having that community input, where you can have experts come in and then add a lot of value to your observation and giving you suggestions on what it might be and things. So really anybody can participate, and that's what's great about it. Like I've seen even just from participating in the last couple of years with the great organization at the Technopark and the events that go on there. I was fortunate to lead a couple walks last year, and we had just people that seemingly that was their first time out in a real green space. Like, we have to wear rubber boots. It was really that sort of experience. And I mean, the kids didn't want to leave. Like, you had to pry them, like, hey, it's time to go. So that's the real power of it too, is, you know, being able to host these events and get people outside. And, you know, the first time a kid sees a garter snake or something like that is really, that could be life changing. You know, they'll be students of ours eventually. Hopefully, that's the sort of idea. So,
And you said scientists, you know, the community with iNaturalist. I think, just in case people don't understand, mm-hmm. when you submit an observation, there are experts that will look at your observation and confirm, yes, that is the correct species identification. And the more that it gets confirmed, mm-hmm. the more that the observation is kind of entered into a more, you know, credible.
That's right.
Arena, if
That's
you
right.
will.
Yeah, they start as a casual observation at first. So when you first submit something, and then it requires two sort of verifications from two different people to go in and sort of either confirm or suggest a different identification. And what's great about that is, if you submit something very general, say for instance you see a lichen or a fungus, maybe something you're not too familiar with, you can submit it, and it may sit sort of in iNat limbo for a while until somebody decides, you know what, I'm going to go check out some of these things. And it's, you know, a lichen expert who, you know, maybe not even a biologist, but just someone who has a real passion for that and knows them very well, can go in and make a suggestion, and then it sort of brings it back up to the top, sort of thing. And then other people will see it, and you'll get those suggestions too. And like, I've had some interesting observations where I've submit something, I'm not quite familiar with what it is, and the back and forth between experts, like just they're saying, oh, well, you know, it has this part, so maybe it's this, and oh, I think you're right, and that sort of discussion that goes on just on the app is really incredible. And so even as maybe someone who, whether you have experience or not, just witnessing that sort of identification process happen is really, it's quite educational. You learn quite a bit just by, you know, having experts go back and forth on decisions and things like that. And it's fun to watch. And, you know, anybody can go in and also identify, which is a big part of, you know, following the City Nature Challenge. We do encourage that people do this, and we try to do this as much, you know, it's fun for me. Sort of in an evening, I'll go through, I'll look at all the observations, and, you know, I'm I'm an entomologist by training, but, you know, I'm good with birds and trees and those sorts of things. So I like to just go in and I'll go to those groups that I'm really comfortable with, and I'll suggest, you know, identifications as well. And sometimes, most of the time I'm right. I'll usually only go into the ones I'm really sure of, but that's the power of it too, is, you know, I'll go in, if I know that that's, say, a red maple, I'll go in and give that suggestion, and then maybe someone else will come in and say, oh, yeah, he is correct, and then it becomes research grade. And so then that observation now goes to a whole new echelon where it can be used by researchers and can actually be used for scientific research and then published further on too, which is really interesting. So yeah, it is a very powerful tool in that sense, that community of experts.
Wow. Yeah. One thing I thought of, you know, this weekend when this is going on, something I've never done yet, but I, you know, it's been on my list of things to do, put on the rubber boots and go into a marsh to find frogs mating at night with a flashlight.
That's cool.
Have you done it?
I have, yeah. And as a kid, too.
And why is it better to go at night?
Well, that's when the sort of reproduction peaks. That's when they sing the most, and that's when they're most active, certainly, sort of as the sun's going down and well into the night.
And does it seem like you can get closer to them at that time of...
Generally, you can if you go in with a headlamp or a flashlight. Again, it sort of stuns them to have the light on them.
Right.
So often you can get much closer that way. But there's just also, depending where you go, there's just such a high density of them that sort of no matter where you look, there's some. So, you know, that's at the peak times of year. That's
That's cool. That's cool. Andy, I wanted to ask you about... You know, you're originally from Australia, right?
That's right, yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of biodiversity in Australia. Do you come to Canada and you're like, ah, oh, this is like so much less biodiversity? Or
It's less deadly, that's for sure. But no, it's just different, right? I love the four seasons. I've been here for 16 years now, so I really enjoy the four seasons. February, you guys can have February, but everything else I really like. It's just different, but it's great in its own right. You know, like speaking as a birder, just the migration experience is mind-blowing. We have pockets of migration, we have some altitudinal migration in Australia, but we don't have this mass coming through in one particular month and staggered depending on species. Mm-hmm. And you know, that, like, just before this interview I took a little detour and spent half an hour at Park Summit doing a bit of birding, and I went there specifically.
Did you see anything good?
I did, yeah. I went there specifically because I thought I'm going to get my first of season yellow rump warbler, and right at the end of the walk, which often happens when you're birding, you're like, no, I dipped, I didn't get it today, and there was one calling, so I recorded its call a little bit, put it on eBird, but it's just always every year, like, I'll see a yellow rump warbler at the end of May and I'll be like, okay, whatever, buddy, like, move on. But every year you get that first of season bird, and it reignites you. Even when the grackles arrive to my feeder, you know, in April, late March, it's exciting. So that I really like that about North America, that you have these, you know, massive waves, and also the chance of rarities in certain times of a year when you get, you know, those big easterly winds coming over from Europe, that anything can pop up there. We're seeing a Russian species of raptor make its way around Newfoundland and Maine. There's been other Asian species turn up in, I think there was a, I can't even remember the species, but one turned up in downtown, like in a backyard in New Jersey, something that shouldn't be there, should be, you know, 10,000 kilometers away kind of thing. I think you have more likelihood of that. What Australia does have is the endemics, the birds you can't see anywhere else but Australia. And so that's the draw there for Australian birds.
And we know he has a massive life list.
it's medium. It's massive to me, but small in... Sure. Big list or numbers. Sure. Yeah.
You know, I used to look at the Guinness Book of World Records, and as a birder when I was a kid, it was a Canadian who had the biggest life list. Norman Chesterfield, I think, was his name. Right. I don't think it's him anymore, but he had seen 5,000 and something of the world's, like, at the time 8,000 mm-hmm. known species or something like that.
Someone just cracked 10,000 a few weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah,
wow.
I think he's a U.S. diplomat. And so he was working a lot in South America, moving wow. around. And yeah, he just got 10,000.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. See, back then, I don't think they had even known of the existence of thousands of those other species. Yeah. It still happens, right? New species are still discovered, even of birds, you know? So we've been talking a lot about the BioBlitz, but there's other aspects of the Campus Biodiversity Network that we haven't talked about. So, Catherine, what other aspects are there about the Campus Biodiversity Network?
Well, we've been speaking about the 4 days that are coming up, and we want to encourage everybody to come out. Mm-hmm. It's the same principle behind it that I think has been evoked here, which is that every observation counts, and every observation can count for conservation. What we see in a lot of our campuses, such as Dawson, Dawson's had kept meticulous records of biodiversity observations and archives that have been internal to Dawson. So what the Campus Biodiversity Network projects facilitate is that kind of public-facing documentation. So anybody who makes an observation on campus can immediately see that observation tallied for the campus project. It's accessible to everybody. Through the URLs for each of those campus projects. So what we do beyond the City Nature Challenge involvement for the BioBlitz is we tally those observations in permanent projects all year long, and we can use those to show how some of our institutional gestures are improving biodiversity. So we can say we've planted, for example, at Venue, we're planting common milkweed in the hope of attracting more pollinators, monarchs, to campus. So those profiles enable us to have a kind of quantifiable snapshot of what we're doing institutionally to improve our green space management practices. And then we are able to forge a broader community outside of Greater Montreal and even Quebec. So right now in Quebec, I believe we have 24 higher education institutions that are enrolled, close to 30 in all of Canada. And we have 50 that are registered internationally. That includes the University of Oxford. It includes University of Cape Coast, Ghana, University of Tokyo. We have the University of Campinas in Brazil that has recently come on. And that's really neat, too, to watch the biodiversity of those campuses.
And as a founder, did you just reach out to them and they said yes? Or?
Yes, so our connection, the Campus Biodiversity Network's connection to many of the international institutions has been through, not all, but many, has been through the University of Oxford's Nature Positive University Pledge Alliance.
Which, and I think McGill is also a member of.
Yeah, yeah, McGill. There are 11 universities in Quebec, and then two CEGEP, so Dawson and Vanier. And there was interest expressed from the University of Tokyo in Campus Biodiversity Network, and we've been in regular communication with the University of Oxford. So now when you go to make that pledge, it's a high-level administrative pledge that is required for universities and colleges. There's a question on that sign-up sheet asking whether they would like to join the Campus Biodiversity Network, and so many of the campuses come to us that way.
Nice,
so we set up
nice.
Profiles for them, and many people are unaware of the kind of power of iNaturalist and quickly become very engaged with it.
And then there was this grant from the Entente Canada-Quebec that some CEGEPs got, and then some of that money has been going towards creating self-guided campus biodiversity trails or walks, right?
Yeah, that's right. Last year we had four colleges, so CEGEP, Champlain, Lennoxville, Champlain-St. Lambert, Vanier, and John Abbott. And this year we have added Heritage College in Gatineau and Dawson, Dawson's been involved informally with the Campus Biodiversity Network from its inception, really, but to come onto the grant. So this involves setting up generally 7 to 9 panels, often around the edge habitat of our campuses, just giving people more information about the biodiversity we can find on campus.
Nice. And Brian, and I'll go to you in a sec, Andy, but Brian, how do you document or how have you been documenting internally all these observations?
Yeah, so we've been, like Kathy had been saying, we've been documenting biodiversity on campus for about 10 years. And kind of like Chris was saying, I've been really lucky to have excellent students. I'm the coordinator of the environmental science program at Dawson, and I have been for a while now. And the students that we get are just generally interested in nature, right? And so it's not a hard sell to say, hey, do you want to have class outside today? And so a lot of the kind of independent projects that students have been working on throughout my career at Dawson have been related to campus grounds and documenting biodiversity. And in fact, the entire biodiversity project at Dawson started because of a group of students. They said, hey, let's count how many species we have in this garden. Mm. And it was actually just when we first put our nurse log into one of our outdoor gardens, and they were documenting how many species were on the log. And then that grew to in that garden. And then it grew to on the entire campus. Mm. And it's only since joining the Campus Biodiversity Network that we were able to, like Kathy said, have a public-facing profile. As opposed to all this information sitting on a drive somewhere that only I have access to. The students actually wanted to create kind of like a campus biodiversity database on the Dawson webpage. And I think the logistics of that was just way too complicated. So iNaturalist came to save us from that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you use iNaturalist.
Yeah, we use iNaturalist, yeah.
Nice. And Andy, what were you going
to
say?
I just wanted to hear from the bug guy because I hadn't heard from him for a while, but he just spoke, so that's awesome. But while I've got his attention, insects, if we wanted to increase insect diversity on campus, what would be some tips for you?
Well, one of the easiest things you can do is plant flowers, mm-hmm. right? Plant some wildflowers, local wildflowers, not garden flowers, mm-hmm. which are usually invasive or... Mm-hmm. introduced. Mm-hmm. So with having milkweed on campus, having, you know, like fleurs de champ, like field flowers mm-hmm. that are local, that's going to attract a lot of pollinators, which will then attract their predators, right? That's kind of an easy way to increase insect biodiversity. Mm-hmm. Another good way is to leave trees where they fall. Mm-hmm. Have decaying wood on campus, mm-hmm. right? That's going to be excellent habitat in, on, and under that log, which will attract beetles and all kinds of other invertebrates, and that will start to decompose that log. And as the log decomposes, you actually attract different species, right? And then woodpeckers come in because they're going to eat those species, mm. right? So, which then in turn just flourishes for biodiversity.
Mm. Okay, cool. Mm.
One of the cool species that we have on campus actually is the locust borer. So it's one of my favorite types of beetles, a longhorn beetle, but it looks like a wasp.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it has that yellow-black coloration on it. And I've actually only ever seen it at Dawson.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, and I've been looking.
Yeah. How big?
It's about three centimeters long.
So not a tiny insect.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Yeah. And there's usually end of summer, right when the fall semester is starting, we get a whole bunch of them in the gardens. They're feeding on the goldenrod.
Wow! Mm-hmm. Cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So maybe we'll take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back after that. We've been talking to Catherine Collin from Vanier College, and Chris Cluche, who's also from Vanier College, and Brian Mader from Dawson College, and Andy Plimer from John Abbott College, who are all involved in the Campus Biodiversity Network. So we'll take a little break, as I said, for some music, but we'll be right back after that here on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And here's an old tune by Gary Newman called Down in the Park.
Down in the park. Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
All right, we're back. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. We're almost out of time here. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show, and we've been talking all about the Campus Biodiversity Network and the City Nature Challenge, which there's a lot of focus coming up for this coming long weekend. I guess not long weekend for most people who are working, but 4 days of BioBlitz, where basically cities are competing with each other to make the most observations of various species. Could be bird, could be plant, could be animal, could be a species of fungi, whatever it is. And so we've been talking all about it. So we've had Chris Cluche and Catherine Collin from Vanier College, both members of the faculty there, and Andy Plimer from John Abbott College, where he's a colleague of mine because I teach at John Abbott as well, and Brian Mader, who is a biology teacher at Dawson College. So I guess during the break we discussed a little bit what we thought was important to say, and one thing is to focus your observations on indigenous species or wild species as much as possible. Right.
Yeah, so there's, especially with the kind of competitive framework, there may be a desire to document as many species as possible. You don't want to go necessarily to the botanical garden and take pictures of all the species that are planted there, because it's a challenge that is geared towards documenting wild species. You can indicate that you have planted a species, and just there's a little checkbox on iNaturalist to let you indicate that that's a casual, cultivated observation, keeping our focus on biodiversity and trying to increase that biodiversity based on what we plant.
Chris, I mean, I know you being involved in the Environmental and Wildlife Management program at Vanier College, you must have documented aquatic species. And I do remember last year during this BioBlitz, there were observations even on the McDonald campus that must have been a fish biologist type teacher had taken his students out, and they had used traps, I think, and they trapped various fish and then counted them in the BioBlitz.
Mm-hmm. I guess if you're fortunate enough to have the permits to do that and be able to, that'd be fantastic, yeah.
Because you would require permits, right?
Yeah, when handling vertebrates usually, so yeah, for amphibians and fish, it would likely require a handling permit. But for things like, you know, aquatic invertebrates, I mean, you're talking all these larval insects and things which are quite abundant actually at this time of year, caddis, flies, mosquito larvae, a whole variety of things. If you just had a dip net or even just a pot on the end of a stick, and you can sort of dip into a pond and just with a white bowl or a white tray, dump them in there, and you can get some good photos that way, and you find a variety of things. And I think that's where, you know, again, talking about the power of iNaturalist and those identification abilities, you see a little squirmy thing. It looks like something. You can sort of tell that it's different from the other thing and submit a bunch of those photos, even if you really don't know what it is. Submit it as insect, but maybe it's not an insect, maybe it's a worm, and then someone will come in and say, actually, you know what, that thing does have a visible head on it or something, and it actually is an insect. And so that's where that, you know, again, the power of that community of identifiers comes in.
Maybe we would discover those nasty flathead worms. Have you heard about these? They got introduced through a house plant, I think, or something like that. Oh. Or, you know, keeping, but they're a parasitic, or not necessarily parasitic, but they prey on other things in the soil, and they're toxic. And I think they're a danger to people as well. Have you heard about them, Kathy?
It was recently, maybe a month and a half ago or something.
So anyways, that's an aside.
Actually, I think there's relevance in terms of documenting invasives. You know, one of the great challenges for any urban green space is to try and manage invasives. And we do have invasive species in Montreal. The common buckthorn that was planted as an ornamental shrub is really awful for bird life and biodiversity. So trying to manage that, garlic mustard, for example, things we don't want to have on our campuses or in our natural environment.
And you know, even talking about the things, you know, you were mentioning before, birds, plants, fungi, whatever it might be to identify. It can also be evidence of animals being there, whether it be tracks or, say, identifiable holes in trees, things like, you know, the emerald ash borer leaves a rather distinct mark inside the trees, so you can identify it as that too. Certain woodpeckers, he's identified by the holes that they make, so other evidence can be used as well.
Scats as well,
yeah. Absolutely.
And a dead specimen, right? If you find a dead animal by the side of the road, you can photograph it and upload that, I think.
Yeah.
It's
took a dark turn.
Yeah, sorry. That's it.
If I could jump in.
Yeah, please, Andy.
I think one of the things I really like about iNaturalist and the setup, you know, being a birder there, and I'm sure this is the same in, you know, plant communities, insect communities, those kind of things. There tends to be some, you know, gatekeeper kind of mentality, or people who have been appointed or have appointed themselves as gatekeepers to that community, and they're all knowing, and they know where the rarities are, and they're only that bird is only that bird unless they identify it. And I think that can iNaturalist completely strips that away. And if we talk about young people trying to get connected with nature, I would think if, you know, someone my age said to a young person, "No, what are you thinking? That's crazy. That can't be that." Or if they get it delivered to them in a way that iNaturalist does, it's way more favorable to keep them connected to making further observations and developing a passion in whatever area it would be.
Absolutely.
I'll just say briefly, too, to build on that, that the beauty of iNaturalist is in its simplicity. So I know we've been talking about tracking our campus biodiversity, and we do that through these specific things called polygons that we set up, where you can walk onto the campus space and use biodiversity, use an iNaturalist to tally the biodiversity observations. It'll count for those campus spaces. And that sounds a little bit complicated. For the purposes of the BioBlitz, or for the purposes of any iNaturalist observation all year long, it suffices to simply walk out your front door, use the app, take a picture with the app, and submit it. That's it. Mm-hmm. And that gesture can then be tallied for international research. It can be used for conservation measures, but there's no additional step. There's no need to join a project, to submit to a specific place, to choose a specific place. The geolocated services on people's smartphones are sufficient to register the observation. So it's that simple. Walk outside, take a picture with the app, and press submit. And that's actually quite a monumental gesture for conservation in our city spaces.
And also, it's great for just keeping records for yourself of where you see particular things. We do this for a variety of trees. We have certain rare trees when we do our tree identification walks and things. We take a photo of it, so then we have that reference later on. So, great little tool.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's 11:56. I think we have maybe time for just a couple more comments, and then we'll start to wrap it up. Maybe Catherine, if you just want to summarize all these great events happening at Vanier again this week.
Oh wow! Okay.
And they're open to the public.
Yes. Yeah, so we have about 10 different talks. They're all posted on the Vanier College Sustainability Symposium page. Of note, as I mentioned, we have Lunish coming. I forgot to mention that earlier, to talk about wildlife rescue. Ganawake's Environmental Protection Office sharing their really spectacular restoration efforts. And Carly Zeter, so that's tomorrow. On Thursday, we have nature illustrators in the morning, and we have Morgan Jackson, who is a biologist, coming to talk about the use of iNaturalist. So if you'd like a kind of crash course on how to use iNaturalist, and then a poet speaking to us as well, and that's for the Wednesday and the Thursday, and then we'll have BioBlitz events. Our students are involved in community observations at the Technopark wetlands. That runs from 9 to 3 p.m. on Saturday at the Technopark, and that too is open to all, and every single iNaturalist biodiversity observation helps advance the conservation of those spaces.
And speaking of Technopark, it really is a place with so much biodiversity, and it's right there in the middle of a industrial area near the Dorval Airport, the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Airport. And I mean, it still has many challenges in terms of becoming a conserved area. There's a small part of it, I think, that's actually part of a protected area, but the rest is all possibly going to be developed. And it's really a community of people that have come together to really promote what an amazing space it is and how much biodiversity it has. So I guess they participated last year as well.
Yeah, and those iNaturalist projects that are dedicated to the different sectors have been hugely important for convincing decision makers to protect the site because of the public-facing nature of these biodiversity profiles through iNaturalist. So coming out to make observations really is a tangible gesture that every single person can make for biodiversity.
That's right. And if people don't know where it is, it's in the borough of St. Laurent, and it's pretty easy to find. And like I said, it's very close to the Dorval Airport. And, you know, I'm always astounded at all the different species that have been identified there, especially birds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's really great. So that's happening Saturday. No events Sunday, as far as we know, but people obviously can...
I think Dorval is having a few cities are running bioblitzes. Dorval is possibly having a bioblitz on that.
Yeah. And we haven't mentioned St. Anne de Bellevue, and I'm on city council in St. Anne de Bellevue, and St. Anne is participating officially. It's encouraging people to go to the Morgan Arboretum for those four days and make observations at the Morgan Arboretum, which is a large forested area. In fact, Chris used to work there as a naturalist when he was a student at McGill campus at McGill. And it's also where the McGill Bird Observatory is, and so people can find out more from the St. Anne de Bellevue website. I know, Andy, you're going to be bringing your students there on Friday.
That's right, Friday, Sunday, and Monday, actually.
Wow.
It's my second classroom.
That's it. I love it. Yeah, and that's it. So Monday, is your final day to make observations for this City Nature Challenge. I guess it's midnight on the Monday.
It's 11:59 p.m. on the Monday. It starts 12:01 a.m. on the Friday morning. But a quick tip is that if you make observations, you have about 4 days after the BioBlitz is over to upload them to iNaturalist to get them to camp for the City of Greater Montreal.
That's great. Okay, well, we're out of time, so thank you all for participating. We had Chris Cluche and Kathy Collin from Vanier College, both faculty members there. We had Andy Plimer from John Abbott College, and we had Brian Mader from Dawson College, and I'm Ryan Young from John Abbott College, but also the host of this show, Equilibrium. So thanks for listening, and you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. Have a great day, and it's beautiful weather, and make some biodiversity observations starting on the 26th of April. Vibes, masses at work, you gotta hear it. In West Indian rhythms on Saturday night, roots rock reggae, I keep it tight. Mancha, I hit the switches, keep it right. Decipher on a Friday, Psalms are soul, I do with my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together, it's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Man Challenge, John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune in to CKUT, always.